Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey. Today's show is going to be really interesting for you because we're going to talk about some things that you probably haven't heard of. You might have heard of attachment theory. You've certainly heard about trauma on the show before and how it can turn some things on in your brain that you probably don't know are going on. And hypnosis, even, we've covered a little bit. But when you tie that back to ancient traditions of meditation and things that are part and parcel to how I became a biohacker, how I became who I am today, it's a Buddhist meditation master. Oh, except he's also an associate clinical professor of psychology at Harvard who has taught hypnotherapy and has been on faculty for 40 years. So we're talking about a man who is really one of the masters. And that is a big point of what I do with the show. I get to learn from the masters. You get to learn from the masters. His name is Dan Brown, a PhD, and a real expert in what trauma does to us, especially in early childhood. Dan, is a great honor to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for hosting me.
40 years of being on faculty at Harvard. What has changed in your field over 40 years that has you most hopeful?
I think the teaching of medicine has changed. We're much more interpersonal now, much more sensitive to the needs of the client.
Why did it change?
Because it used to be operated under a third surgeon model in the 1950s and 60s, which was teaching students by shaming them.
Wow. Just throw it out there.
Now there's so much to learn that people have to team up. So everybody's responsible for collecting a certain amount of information different from the team. So it's non-competitive and it's all sharing based. So that's changed remarkably.
That is a big shift in a relatively short period of time. It seems like in medicine, historically, it's almost taken one generation to pass away for the next one to come in and create incremental change. Do you feel like it's the pace of change in medicine is accelerating?
Yeah, there's too much information, so it's hard to keep up with it all.
Let's talk about attachment first, and then I want to talk about the ancient bone traditions and things that you've studied. But attachment, what is it? Because a lot of people listening may not understand even the basics of what it is, but just walk me through how it happens and what it is.
There are two relational maps. The first one forms at about 12 to 20 months, and that's the attachment map. The second one forms about a third and fourth year of life. That's called the CCRT, or Core Conflict Relationship Theme Map. The difference between those two maps is the second map is much more complicated and it's much more accessible to memory. So the difference, put simply, is that the difference between whether you have trouble with relationships or within relationships. So attachment map is about trouble with relationships.
So trouble with relationships. So if someone is having a hard time in a relationship, what is the likelihood that their attachment patterns from early childhood are playing a major role?
High, very high. So the attachment field started with Bowlby's work in the 1940s. He saw attachment as an interplay between providing a secure base for the infant, and the paradox of human attachment is the more secure they feel in the relationship, the more they explore and become independent. So he found attachment to be an interfacing of two complex issues. One is attachment and bonding, and the other is exploration. And in the 1950s and 60s, Mary Ainsworth developed a laboratory paradigm to directly observe kids in the attachment phase. So that kids in 10 to 20 months are brought into the laboratory in what's called a strange situation. They're put in an unfamiliar playroom. There's two chairs in the room. There's a bunch of toys on the floor. And there's a big plastic box filled with toys. They're given no instructions. And for 3 minutes, you watch what happens between the mother and the child. Secure kids will settle down in the playroom and get used to it. They'll get interested in more and more of the toys. And then and they'll look to the mother and check in with the mother and see that they're secure. And then they'll venture further out and check in again and venture further out. That's secure attachment. After 3 minutes, a stranger walks in the room unannounced and fed to the research. And you see the child's differential response to the stranger and how that affects the play behavior. After 3 minutes, the stranger leaves. And the mother leaves and then the room is in the stranger is in there with the room with the child for 3 minutes. You see how the stranger affects the presence, affects the play behavior. Then the mother comes back and the stranger leaves, and you see the reunion behavior, how that affects the play behavior. Then the mother leaves a second time and the child is left alone in the room this time, and you see how that affects the play behavior. So you get all the possibilities in there. And there are four possibilities that come up. Securely attached kids show a differential response and preference for the mother. And the more secure they feel in the room with the mother, the more complex the play behavior gets. They explore more. Kids who grow up, they have what we call dismissing attachment. They just deactivate the attachment system. They just do the toys. They don't care the mother's presence, whether they're alone or whether they're with a stranger. They just don't seem to connect with the relationship. They deactivate the attachment system and they just have a kind of pseudo-independence. In adulthood, we call it that dismissing attachment. They don't connect easily in relationships. The opposite of that is what's called anxious preoccupied attachment. Those are kids who shut down the exploratory system and they get over-clingy in the attachment system. So they can't play in the strange situation, in an unfamiliar environment. They just only can cling to the mother. And when the mother leaves, they get disorganized and they can't play anymore. And they're unconsolable when the mother comes back. And then the fourth kind is where you deactivate both the attachment system and the exploratory system. We call that disorganized attachment. So those are the four paradigms.
What percentage of people, I'm just going to say over 18 in the world today, do you think have those attachment systems mostly done
There's
right?
There's good research both in North America and in Europe, in the West, and the figures are fairly stable across studies. About 2 out of 3 people have secure attachment, about 1/3 doesn't. And about that 1/3, about 10-12% are disorganized. 10 and 12% are about anxious, preoccupied attachment, and about 10% are dismissive.
So, people listening to the show have a one in three chance of having an attachment problem. Would you know you had an attachment problem?
Not necessarily.
How would someone be able to look in the mirror and say, "Wow, I think that might be me"?
Because one of the things that happens with attachment is, when the child is securely attached, the parents are constantly mirroring the child's feelings and internal state of mind. And from that, the child develops what's called metacognitive capacity, the capacity to reflect on their own state of mind. So that when there's attachment impairment, in addition to that, they always have metacognitive deficits. So they don't observe themselves very well, and they don't really know that they have a problem. They just play out the same problem over and over again, but they don't even know why.
Wow. 1 in 3. And of course, they're going to have an impact on everyone else in the world around them.
And then of the 1 in 3 that have the 2/3 that have a secure attachment, about 40% of those are going to have core conflict relational themes. They have a different map. They'll keep selecting for the same old problems in relationships. They'll select dysfunctional partners.
So that would be a sign. Someone who continuously has bad relationships over and over, the common element is you, and it's probably attachment at least playing a role in that, because you're picking a partner who has a similar attachment problem. Is that what's going on?
No, that's a separate map. That's a CCRT map, the core conflict relations. that develops about a third or fourth year of life.
That's the second one. Okay.
And that one's, so there are two relational dysfunctional maps here. You have 2 chances to get it wrong.
It turns out that healthy attachment was the main focus of the way my wife, who is a medical doctor and studied drug and alcohol addiction, actually worked in the field for a while in Sweden. That was what we focused on for our first 4 or 5 years of the kids, was just get that right. They can probably be happy later in life, even if we screw something else up as parents.
It makes a difference.
Thank you for helping to push that work and that agenda, because I wouldn't have known about that before we had kids if I hadn't been able to go out and read some things about it. And I'm curious, because you have learned Tibetan, Buddhist Sanskrit, Pali. You're a Buddhist meditation master. How much of this attachment, sort of Western theory, is taught in the ancient knowledge that you've studied? Are you seeing reflections of it, or are these unrelated?
Unrelated.
Unrelated. Interesting. Okay. Then why did you go down the path of Buddhism?
Because in the West, we study psychopathology, psychiatric conditions. In Buddhism, they study the positive states. States that's the other half of the map. Once you work through the negative stuff, all it leaves you with is a basic everyday unhappiness. But if you work on developing the mind in a positive sense, you move beyond unhappiness to contentment in life and to awakening.
So first you fix the broken stuff, and then you upgrade or enhance or train or hone, whatever the right words are, the good stuff, so that you can reach that state of non-suffering.
Not just non-suffering, but positivity.
Positivity, okay.
There's a certain point where you eradicate all negative states in practice, a very advanced practice, and you have a flourishing of 80 positive states, the Buddha mind. We actually are studying the neuroscience of that right now. We have enough subjects who can do that now. In the West, that we're studying what's happening in the brain when that happens.
I am very interested in that to the extent that I have a small neuroscience facility in Seattle that is training people on complex states in different parts of the brain with gamma brainwaves, with the desire to put them in those advanced altered meditation states that are out there. And I'm just so impressed with the amount of neuroscience that's come out in the last 20 years.
We have the only neurocircuitry study on awakening.
Oh, that's incredible.
You found something very, very distinct. 29 subjects, and they all had to show the same thing. There's an area of the parietal system that opens up that shifts from more local to a very huge perspective on awareness. And we found gamma activity in all 29 subjects in that area of the brain, that region of interest. So awake means awake.
Now you're seeing gamma. I'm assuming this is an electrical study, EEG study?
Study I did in collaboration with Judd Brewer when he was at UMass Medical School.
Okay, but you're getting electrical, not blood flow or any other things like that, right?
No, we were looking at 2828 channel EEG.
Okay, beautiful. And studying actual awakened states, that is powerful. And I'm very interested, and probably deeper than what most of the audience would want to hear about, but around these new states, gamma and how they ride on other states, where it feels like we're right on the cusp of having enough samples to the point of the study that you're participating in, as well as just enough pictures of normal brains to be able to really tease out more and more and more information about what human brains are capable of.
Well, think about a possible scenario where you don't have any negative states really in your experience, and you have you manifest 180 80 states of positive states at once. I happen to think that has profound implications for mental health.
I would say so.
So this, in the last 10 years, has been a positive psychology movement, 10 to 20 years now, research on positive states. And I think that that has profound implications for mental health. That's why we're studying it.
Can you do it?
Yes.
How often do you put yourself in all 180 positive states at the same time?
More the day than not.
Wow. Well, I am working on that same state, but I would say I still have some work to do. That's profound. Would you attribute your ability to do that, to reach this state of positivity more often than not, and we're talking very deep positivity, is it because of your study of this ancient knowledge, the Tibetan bone tradition, or is it from something else?
Yes. I worked with the Tibetans for 48 years now. That's a long time.
And you did study with the Dalai Lama, which is amazing.
I was studying with him in the 1970s, my first root lama, and he was very close. But now, in the last 12 years, I studied with His Holiness Menri Trizin, the head of the indigenous Bon religion. He's the Dalai Lama's senior Dzogchen teacher, great completion teacher. And he's the best meditation teacher I ever had. He's very, very, very profound. He died last year. But what he asked me to do was 6 years ago, and he said, he brought out a lot of these advanced curved cave and hermitage yogi texts, and he said, these are the practices that are going to die out in this generation alone. I have a favor to ask you, would you translate them all? When you put them in a form that works for Westerners, what are we going to do, say, no, I don't feel like it? So I suspended my clinical practice and most of my clinical teaching for 3.5 years, and we got 8 books of translations done in that time.
Can people read these today?
Yes, the cave yogi texts are all collected in a volume called Self-Arising Threefold Embodiment of Enlightenment.
I will put links to that in the show notes, and I will be reading those. Now, something that has always been unanswered in my mind, because I went to Mount Kailash years ago, and I did the Kora around Mount Kailash. For listeners who don't know about this, Mount Kailash is a very holy mountain in Buddhism, in the Hindu religion, and also in Tibetan Bon. And people walk around this in a sort of a holy walk, a 26-mile walk. But in the Bon religion, you walk counterclockwise, and then the Tibetan religion, you walk clockwise. And I walked clockwise because I had just come out of a monastery and spent 10 days there, Kopan Monastery, which you probably are familiar with. And so I learned something about this, but I felt like it was always this sort of corner, like, oh, that's an older religion that's out there. And it seems like it had some shamanic roots in it. Can you describe what you learned, the difference between that older lineage and the other lineages you've studied for people listening? Because I think it's a new idea for almost everyone.
Well, the Buddha Shakyamuni was 2,500 years ago. But there were Buddhas before Shakyamuni Buddha. In the Bon tradition, there was Tomba Sherab, who lived to 7,800 years ago. So their practices are more evolved and more detailed and more accessible. So Dzogchen, for example, great completion practice, as we call it, has been around for 700-800 years. And I find that their texts are far more accessible and much more detailed because they've been doing it much longer. That's why I switched to the Bon.
Okay. So just making it accessible. Do you believe that things like heart rate variability training, neurofeedback, biofeedback, all those different modalities or breathing exercises or even LSD, which you worked with when it was still legal to do that, are any of these ways of accelerating attainment or are those all distractions?
All distractions.
Every one of them. Okay.
In the instant you focus on something or even when the mind moves towards something, at that instant, you're focusing on something particular. And as soon as you start moving in the direction of something particular, you can't grasp the unbounded wholeness. It's always right here.
Mm.
So you see the problem. Every time you look to the feedback on the machine, you're drawing yourself out of that unbounded wholeness.
I have experienced that. And I found when I set my equipment up in certain ways, the only way to make the signal get strong is to not pay attention to the signal, which is very frustrating. It took 2 weeks of focusing on not focusing, if there is such a thing, in order to be able to say, aha. And then you feel this melting and this kind of warmth in your chest. And when you're observing it.
In these traditions, the best way of doing it is not through feedback. The best way of doing it is with pith instructions. We have very clear instructions as part of the detail of intensity of the relationship. The instructions make it open the whole thing up for you.
The instructions of you visualize the Buddha sitting on a thing and visualize it very carefully or some other kinds
no,
of instructions?
No, all instructions about how to open up the mind.
Pith. Can you give me an example?
Yeah, suppose I said to you right now, look into the surrounding space. See it as not empty space, but see it as an awareness space, a field of awareness space that saturates everything without inside, without outside, a field of knowing awareness space. You can do that.
Mm-hmm.
Now look at the timeless aspect of the field. The events will come and go within time, within the field, but the field itself is absolutely timeless. Identify the timeless aspect of the field right now. You got that?
Yeah.
Now extend it out in all directions so it's not only timeless, but boundless and limitless.
Okay.
Come to see that that's where you're operating out of.
It's
how simple that is? Just follow the instructions. It opens it right up. That's what a good teacher does for you.
I absolutely felt that. Although right in the middle of it, somewhere when you went into timeless, I felt a twinge of anxiety, actually, which is strange. There's clearly I have some little internal resistance to overcome for that, but it feels like a good teacher can help you dial in on why that would happen.
You just focus on what, you don't get distracted by it.
So you just ignore it and just keep going into that?
No, if it becomes a problem, then we'll address it. And it's part of the relationship. That's that. All the instructions are given, we say, from heart to heart as part of the relationship.
Wow. It's so mind-blowing, although I guess in this case, maybe mind-enhancing is a better perspective
better
on
way
it.
I'm talking about it, right.
How does it relate to things like PTSD? And a lot of people, because I've done a decent amount of neurofeedback training with clients, and certainly a lot on myself, and it feels like quite often they'll stumble into something that is an old trauma. And I'm asking you because, well, you were a witness for the war crimes tribunal on people who are traumatized. You know about trauma very deeply. Where's the map between these states and trauma, or specifically PTSD?
Well, again, the distinction in East and West is between negative states and positive states. So
okay.
PTSD is, there are two things that are going on from a neurocircuitry point of view. One has to do with an unremitting fear arousal.
Okay.
So the amygdala is like a broken fire alarm. It's the fear arousal center of the brain is constantly on. It doesn't shut off. The medial prefrontal cortex, which usually gives top-down regulation of that, doesn't shut off. It doesn't shut it off. So you get unremitting fear arousal. That's one thing that happens. And that's what we call hyperarousal predominant PTSD, which is about 70% of PTSD cases. So another 30% of PTSD cases that are dissociation predominant. And what they have is not so much fear arousal, but the opposite of that. They disconnect from all the emotions. They disconnect the medial prefrontal cortex from the limbic system. So they don't feel anything, and they don't remember anything. They disconnect the memory circuits for autobiographical emotional memories. So two presentations.
Mm.
One is an unremitting fear arousal, and the other is the lack of feelings, what we call the difference between positive symptoms and negative symptoms. So, and they're different. This Ruth Lanius did a study in Canada where she had a couple who were in a severe motor vehicle accident, and they had different personality styles and different brain styles. So one had dissociation predominant PTSD and the other had hyperarousal predominant PTSD with the same accident. That was pretty convincing.
Wow. That is going to be extremely useful just to have the same thing happen. What about very early birth? I was diagnosed with birth-based PTSD. I was born with a cord wrapped around my neck, and I did some heavy-duty regressive work and breathing and holotropic breathing and a lot of work on that, and have let probably most of it go. What's the role of birth and experiences in the womb with PTSD and these other attachment states that you mentioned later?
Well, the trouble is that we don't have a narrative memory for that. We have a behavioral and active memory for that, but it's not a narrative memory. So if we fill in the blanks with a narrative memory, it's mostly fantasy produced.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't mean it doesn't happen. It doesn't, not traumatic. It just, you tend to register more in terms of bodily states and somatic states rather than in terms of narrative memory.
It would be all body states at the time because, I mean, your prefrontal cortex isn't cooked yet.
that's true. I agree with
you. Okay. Is it real? And this idea that what happens in the womb affects you later in life?
It can. Depends on the person.
Got it.
What if there was a way to level up your energy, get rid of stress, and take more control of your body? Welcome to Quantum Upgrade. This is a new technology that taps into quantum energy to help you feel amazing. Quantum Upgrade has a lot of different products that help protect you from EMF and help activate your body's natural healing abilities. You can expect better sleep, more resilience, less stress, and better blood flow. The cool thing about Quantum Upgrade is that the products are backed by a lot of heavy-duty scientific studies, and there's a new measurable upgrade. You can now use Quantum Upgrade to increase your consciousness levels between 1400 and 2200 on the Hawkins map of consciousness. If you don't know what that means, do some research because it's impressive, it's fun to learn about, and it's something that I've come to understand. Ready to try Quantum Upgrade? Visit quantumupgrade.io/Dave for a 7-day free trial.
Depends on the person. Got it. I spent some time with the founder of the American Pre and Perinatal Psychology Association years ago, and we talked about it a lot. And certainly it seemed like there were some personality types that came out from it. But when I take that and I combine it with all of this other knowledge that's out there, particularly some of the ancient knowledge, I like your model. Okay, fix the broken stuff. And then what else are you going to do here? If someone listening believes that they have early childhood trauma, whether it's around birth or the first 3 or 4 years around that, what would they do? Like, what's the first step to saying, I think I'd like to fix the broken stuff? Who would you go see? How would you?
Well, the standard model that evolved in the field was for what's called phase-oriented trauma treatment, POTT, P-O-O-T-T, phase-oriented trauma treatment. You know, three phases. The first is you stabilize the person. You teach them how to enter safe, in a sense, a zone of safety. You enhance their coping strategies. You help them stabilize their mind. And then only after you do that, you provide them with the tools to stabilize their experience. Then you explore the memories and integrate the memories. And then the third phase is to get them back on the right developmental track. So you enhance their self-development. You enhance their capacity for healthy, mature relationships in adult life. For healthy affective exploration and expression.
How long does that usually take?
A couple of years.
But so hard work.
That was the model of phase-oriented trauma treatment involved in the 1970s and 80s. But then we began to see in the 1990s that for some people it didn't work so well for.
What do you do for those people?
Some of those people we call having complex trauma. And most of the erroneous assumption that developed in the field is that people who had complex trauma had cumulative trauma, many traumatic events. That's not what we found. We did a study called the Orphanage Study. I did a lot of priest abuse cases. So every time we did priest abuse cases, I'd do 2 days of testing. So we got a massive database on people who had recovered memories. So we eventually looked at all that data. And what we found, there was a Catholic orphanage in called Madonna Manor in the 1950s in New Orleans. And the brilliance of the Catholic Church was when the priest got accused of being a pedophile, they put them all together in the same orphanage, running an orphanage. So they had 6 pedophile priests running the orphanage, and then most of they hired a pedophile staff, so you could see the kids were canning fodder for these pedophiles.
That's horrifying.
It's horrifying. So many years later, the mother started recovering memories, and we tested them in some detail. But turned out to be an interesting database because all of them were abused by the same abusers for the same amount of time in the same way physically and sexually. But the difference was attachment status. A lot of them come from broken homes. They had disorganized attachment. You know, the mother was running a brothel in the house. The father was running a meth lab in the basement. And these kids were foraging for food on the streets. So they were picked up by child services and brought to the orphanage. But a lot of the kids were from healthy homes with big Catholic families. So the father would have to work two or three jobs to afford all those kids. And that often meant working a risky job, like working on the oil rigs. And the father would get an industrial accident and he'd get injured or killed. And the family would break up. The kids were sent to the orphanage. Mm. And it turns out the variable was attachment status. So there's a way you can assess attachment in adults called the adult attachment inventory, which is a complicated structured interview, but it's very real. It's the gold standard for assessing attachment in adults. So we gave that to everybody, and we found out there were two groups of the orphanage kids. The ones had secure attachment, and they had circumscribed Axis 1 symptoms like PTSD, depression, anxiety, panic states, somatoform disorders. But then none of them had a personality disorder. None of them had dissociative disorders. But the people who had disorganized attachment, in addition to having those PTSD, they all had a major dissociative disorder, personality disorder, and an emergent dissociative disorder. So what does that tell you? It's not cumulative trauma. It's disorganized attachment aggravated by later abuse in childhood.
Uh-huh.
So because of that, we started changing the model and started to treat the attachment, disorganized attachment, rather than treating the trauma. Because what we found in the 1980s and the 1990s was that people who had assumed that complex trauma was based on more traumatization, they'd keep processing the trauma, and the minds of those patients were getting more and more disorganized. It wasn't working. So we had to adjust the model for this population to treat the attachment disorder as the main primary focus of the treatment. And then later we would treat the attachment, and it was easy, simple memory processing work later in the treatment, in the last 10% of the treatment. And it's easy to, you don't get this interminable going over many, many memories and over and over and over again, finding more and more and more and getting more disorganized. So we just had to adjust a new model for this different group to treat the disorganized attachment first and then the trauma second. And we began to see, after we developed phase-oriented trauma treatment in the 1970s and 80s, we began to see there are other populations of people who didn't fit that successful model of treatment, like victims of sadistic abuse. Sadistic abuse isn't about sex, it's about power and control. So sadistic abusers like to get into the mind of their individuals. So it's often accompanied by mind control games, power and control and asserting dominance, and often by a lot of verbal abuse and physical infliction of pain. So the trouble is that the way that trauma treatment evolved, you make a person feel safe, you give them, go off to a safe place. Then you help them develop coping strategies to deal with intrusive symptoms so they stabilize their symptom picture before you get into the memory processing. And the more you get to know the patient in the treatment, what should happen eventually is when you stabilize them, then you can go start processing the memories. But what happens is that for the people who are victims of sadistic abuse, to be known is to have their mind controlled. So what happens is the further they get into stabilization, the more they back off from the uncovering. And they get more and more unstable because they think they're going to take over their mind. So a traditional approach to transference interpretation. How do you imagine I'm going to take over your mind? You play it off the here and now transference. Let's imagine the ways that I'm going to take over your mind. How am I going to control you? And have them fantasize all the ways that they think they're going to do it. And you have a patient, stable inquiry where you're not actually acting like that, but you're looking into the fact that it could possibly happen with you. Then they feel safe in the relationship that way. It becomes an emotionally corrective relationship, as we call it. So what we began to see is that phase-oriented treatment worked for the large majority of people who were traumatized individuals. But then we had to perfect very different treatments for different folks that didn't work for. So now we have a much more larger perspective on what this given individual may need. That we have to match the treatment to that given individual. So one size doesn't fit all for trauma treatment.
Is there someone who can't be fixed because of their trauma? Or do people just get so broken that there's no hope?
I don't believe that at all.
I don't either. I'm glad you said that.
I couldn't be able to feel for 50 years and believe that.
Yeah.
I think what's changed over 50 years is that I used to start, when I started in the field, with the dominant model was psychoanalysis. So you sort of sat back and just let it unfold. I don't do that anymore. I've spent 50 years reading outcomes research, and now I know where a person needs to go. Yeah. And it'll be much more active to get them there. in the shortest amount of time possible.
If I would trust anyone's opinion on this on Earth, I think given your background and the depth of your exploration here, I would trust that. So thank you for that. So I guarantee you there's someone listening to this show who feels like they're, you know, alone and hopelessly broken. There are things we know now that can get you back to where you want to be, at least back to normal. And if they decide to go down some of the other stuff, there's something far beyond normal that's also possible. So thank you for sharing that.
It's also a Mahayana Buddhist perspective, and great vehicle of the Mahayana. No one is left behind.
Yeah,
I feel exactly. That way also about therapy. No one's left behind.
Yeah, the enlightenment of all beings. Well, let's talk about hypnosis, which is also something where you are very, very knowledgeable. You spent 150 hours with Sirhan Sirhan, who was charged with assassinating Robert F. Kennedy and his attorney. And people have said, oh, maybe he was subjected to coercive hypnosis. What did you learn from that time?
Well, let me say something in general about hypnosis first.
Yeah, okay, let's do it.
Hypnosis is a talent. It's like musical ability. Some people are more talented than others. But 8% of the population is highly hypnotizable. They're the virtuosos of hypnosis.
Mm-hmm.
About 4% of people are not hypnotizable at all, and everybody's in between. Most people are in the moderate range of hypnotizability. What it's a talent for is it's a talent for heightened attentiveness. If you remind people to pay very careful attention and tune everything else out, people will activate a state of heightened attentiveness, and they're very focused, and they can resist distraction in an extraordinary degree and stay on track with things. So that's what we call hypnosis. It's a talent to focus in a very fast and heightened way. But we would say that hypnosis is the treatment. It's the medium of treatment. If you're treating with somebody with anxiety disorders, we know that exposure-based protocols for, say, panic attack work more well. But if you do it in the hypnotic state where you're more focused and less distracted, well, you're going to recover the same ground much more quickly. You still have to bring the right protocol to it. So I wouldn't say that hypnosis is a treatment. You still have to bring to what we know about the best approach to that given condition for that treatment is. But if you do it in hypnosis, it's much quicker, much faster. Now, the second you mentioned Sirhan, I did work with him for 150 hours. And the reason why I got involved in the case is in the year 2006, Brad Johnson, a CNN reporter, was going through the archives in Sacramento, and he found an audio tape that was left by a Canadian filmist, a VCR tape. Remember those?
Mm-hmm. I remember VCRs.
And it had really good sound quality. And if you listen to it with the naked ear, you could hear 13 shots being fired.
Wow.
Simultaneously. If you look at the current generation of software, you can show without a shadow of a doubt that there were 13 shots fired, 5 simultaneously.
Oh my goodness.
Sirhan couldn't have been the main shooter. The other problem was that the Noguchi, who did the autopsy, said it couldn't have been Sirhan that fired the fatal shot on Kennedy because the fatal bullet was to the right side of the neck, point blank, because the powder burns. It was a hollow point that exploded to 200 pieces in the brainstem. That's why he got taken out so thoroughly.
Oh, wow.
Sirhan was in the wrong direction. He was never more than 4 or 5 feet closer.
So the narrative simply isn't true and based on evidence.
It's not based on evidence.
Wow.
So we started, my task was to do non-suggestive interviewing to see if Sirhan remembered anything. We found out more than we thought we should.
Wow.
Sirhan, I've hypnotized 6,000 people in my career, training people in hypnosis. Sirhan is the most hypnotizable person I've ever met.
Wow, so he'd been trained to be hypnotized, probably.
Well, it turns out that when he was a late adolescent, his sister, who was, I think, 3 or 4 years younger than him, died of leukemia. And he was very close to his sister, and he found that unacceptable to him. So he wanted to find out whether there was life after death, so he made his way to the Theosophical Society and eventually the Rosicrucians. He started a hypnosis correspondence course with the Rosicrucians. And at the time, he worked as a hot walker at a Santa Anita racetrack. And he and the kids at the racetrack, they're all brushing down the horses, all were practicing on hypnosis in the same class together. And it was clear that he was enormously different from anybody else's behavior. So that was obvious to the people who ran the racetrack. Now, Sirhan always had a dream to be a jockey, but he never ridden a thoroughbred. And Frankie, who worked at Santa Anita, who was partly mafia involved, called him up one day and said, "I have a job for you to ride thoroughbreds at Corona Ranch. Would you want the job?" And he said, "Yes." It was a dream. You don't take a kid who's never ridden a thoroughbred and give him $250,000 horse to ride. It's too risky for the horse. 2 weeks later, he had a fall from that horse. And he was gone to the emergency room where he had 4 stitches in his eye. And the emergency room said they discharged him that day, but that's not what he remembered. He told me he was missing for 3 weeks, and his mother, who he came home every weekend from that new ranch he was working at, Corona. The mother, we had an affidavit written by her before she died, and his best friend Terry saying he was missing for 3 weeks. That's where they did the programming on him.
And the ranch was called Corona Ranch?
No, it's Corona, the town of Corona. So he was programmed, he was put in a special unit, and they were taking urine samples all day. You don't take urine samples for head injuries, but you do for drugs.
Yep.
So we think
like
they
LSD.
Drugged him. Yeah, we think they drugged him, and they put him in there for 3 weeks. And then when he got out, he had to see this eye doctor, and the eye doctor would spray things in his eyes, and he would get in an altered state of consciousness. And he did that for 12 weeks, and he couldn't drive after that.
Wow.
And then this strange man came up to him. He was waiting in the car after he got across the street. There was a diner. He was waiting in the diner, and the strange man came up to him with a manifesto about shooting government officials, and that was his trainer. And then, but what they did is they trained him to be a distractor. And what became obvious to me was that he was trained to give me certain cues. So one time I tapped him on the shoulder, the arm, the elbow twice like that, which is a typical thing you do for post-hypnotic suggestion. He got up and he started to went up like this. He took a stance like this. And he got his, what we call range mode. He got He started citing military terms, grant you, about shooting at vital human organs. So we learned how to trigger a range mode.
This is Jason Bourne kind of stuff. My goodness.
It is. I couldn't believe it, but they wouldn't let us film anything. But we saw it many times. We could activate range mode and learn the triggers for it. So he was there to be a distractor.
Wow. I mean, when you talk about this, what do people say? Do they believe you, or do they sort of wipe themselves out? That can't be real, and just go about their daily business.
Well, some people believe it. Sundance believed it. Robert Redford and Sundance made a film on it. They made a film of me and all the findings we discovered.
Oh, I haven't seen that film. It's not even in my research. How can I miss that?
It doesn't exist.
Oh,
because 2 years later they did a 3-way contract with Netflix and Showtime, and they cut everything out. They edited everything away.
Oh.
So Shane O'Sullivan, who wrote a documentary on RFK Must Die 10 years ago, was pissed off about the fact that they did that, so he filmed me. He put on a thing called whatwherewhy.org, and now it's made it to YouTube. It's on a thing called The Real Man Shooting Cannon on YouTube.
Wow. Well, I'll put a link to that in our show notes as well. This is truly astounding. I mean, a world-class expert in hypnosis, you'd be very well equipped to do that. Your expertise in attachment theory and these advanced, very advanced meditation states from the past, and Harvard professorship, you're a heck of a guy. Did you come into the world like this? I mean, did you come in half enlightened and you're just on the path, or what's your theory for what makes you able to do these things at the level of excellence you've done them at your entire life?
No, I started as an ordinary student until
what
I was in fourth grade. There was a teacher who really took interest in me, and she saw some talent in me, and I just blossomed that year.
What was her name?
Mrs. Merchant. I went from a C student to a straight A student and never turned back after that.
Did you ever get a chance to thank her?
Yeah, I went back when I was in my 20s, and I was doing my internship at Harvard, and I went back to see her. We both cried. I thanked her for what she did for me.
Yeah. Teachers matter so much, and we've got to pay them more. It would solve so many problems.
I agree.
Yeah.
Changed my life around.
Wow. That's why kids are so precious, because that's when the leverage happens, especially around that time, fourth, fifth grade, even before that. We get it right. And what a difference.
It's not been a boring life, I have to say that.
I would say not.
But I paid dearly for the Sirhan thing. I got 5 tax audits. I have a tag on my account from the U.S. Treasury Department, top official saying they should harass me as possible within the boundaries of law for the rest of my life. Every time I got on the plane for 3 years, they took my bags and they would search them, and I'd get them back 2 days later.
Do you regret it?
No, I'm pissed off. That shouldn't happen. There's no police state. I'm of the belief that you have kids. I think what we pass on to our future generation is important. We have a precious democracy here. I don't want to piss it away. It's worth fighting for.
Well, guys, my mind is blown, and I think this is more than one episode. So what we're going to do is record another whole hour's worth of storytelling and learning for you with Dan Brown, because there's a whole bunch more about self-esteem and about the development of the self that we're going to go into. And if you enjoyed this episode, I would love it if you heard the second one. It is my intent on Bulletproof Radio to learn from the masters. And if you haven't figured it out by now, this is one of the living legends, one of the masters. And what a fantastic mind-expanding interview so far. I can't wait to do the next half of it.
My pleasure. I look forward to coming back.
If you'd like to learn more, go to attachmentproject.com. That's just as you'd expect it to be spelled, attachmentproject.com. You can learn more about Dan's work, but his work is very broad and very deep. You could spend a year studying it or more and probably still not do everything. I'll see you all in the next episode.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.